please welcome to the stage Tim Marshall, Nick Middleton, Anna Reid, and Julia Wheeler.
That's right.
Great. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Stamford's Travel Writers Festival and to what I think is going to be a very meaty discussion. It's one which you may well want to contribute to towards the end of our conversation, so do feel free to do that. My name is Julia Wheeler, and I'm delighted to introduce three people who bring their own experience and expertise to the debate about the role that maps and geography play in national identity. We're going to be asking, among other things, the question, what makes a country? Tim Marshall is a journalist, writer, and broadcaster on foreign affairs who worked at Sky News for 25 years and has covered pretty much every conflict in the Middle East and Europe since 1992. His latest book, here's one he made earlier, is Prisoners of Geography, 10 Maps That Will Tell You Everything You Need to Know About Global Politics. Anna Reid was the Kiev correspondent for The Economist and The Telegraph in the 1990s and has since covered Ukraine for Newsweek and The Spectator. Her latest book is Borderland, A Journey Through the History of Ukraine. Nick Middleton is a geographer, writer, and television presenter, perhaps most famously in the Channel 4 programme Going to Extremes. He teaches on geographical, travel, and environment issues, and his audiences range from primary school children to policymakers. I think we're somewhere probably in between today. His latest book is An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist. So please welcome your Politics of Borders panel.
Thank you.
Your contention is that countries and their leaders are often constrained by geography.
You say pretension or contention?
Contention.
Contention. Good. Yes, I believe they are. I think it's the overlooked aspect in news reporting. We talk about the politics, we talk about the history, but we don't usually explain the geography, especially of a conflict, and it's crucially important. And the easiest example I've opened in chapter one is Russia. If we put a slide of Russia up, you can see that there's something called the North European Plain, and that comes from France all the way to the Ural Mountains. And so all that area in front of Russia is flat. And if we can find the Carpathians, which if you look down through Poland, yeah, the Carpathians are just at the edge of that screen. Look below the P of Poland. That is the narrowest point in the North European Plain. It's only 300 miles wide. It then opens out to 2,000 miles of flatland. So if you're Russia and you keep getting invaded through that corridor, I'm not talking about the morality of this. The geopolitics of it is that you will push forward, dominate that flatland, including Ukraine, which I'm sure Anna will have something to about, and even plug that gap in Poland, which explains why Poland sometimes disappears off the map. And I just think that sort of context, and the other one being that if your ports freeze, because it's up there in the Arctic, and your only warm water port is in somewhere called Crimea, you are a prisoner of your geography. You will invade Crimea and take that port.
And one of the things you say is that Putin has the same problems in his mind as the Tsars did.
Yeah.
Ostensibly, why wasn't there a mountain range in Ukraine?
That's what he wakes up every night screaming, God, why didn't you put a mountain range on the border, somewhere around Kiev and the Dnieper River, the river? And that would have changed history. But history has played out partially, because of the geographic factor. And as I said, in most conflicts that I've reported on, the news has not explained enough. I mean, you know, we've got other examples in Europe and in the Middle East. And geography plays a huge part in what is happening right now.
Not least, as you say, in terms of access to the seaports. And you also talk about Russia's invasion of Afghanistan being with the eventual aim, perhaps, of getting down into those warm waters south of Afghanistan, Pakistan area.
There's a famous saying in Russia about washing our boots in warm waters. And the route through is through Afghanistan and getting down to Pakistan. And some people believe that was what the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was all about. It was about access to the sea lanes. If you put the one of Europe up, I'll show you how hard it is for the Russians. At the top in the north, it's frozen. The ports are frozen for 5-6 months a year. So you can't be a great world global power with a navy that only operates half of the year. So, okay, you've got your warm water port there in Crimea, at the bottom of Ukraine, which is now de facto part of Russia, in Sebastopol. But to get out of the Black Sea, you've got to come past Romania and Bulgaria and Turkey, which are three NATO powers. You've got to go through the Bosphorus. It's only a mile wide. The 1933 Treaty of Montreux means they have to ask Romania for permission to sail past. This is also why America is busy beefing up the Romanian Navy. Even then, you're going past Greece, NATO power, Italy, NATO power with an entire fleet in the Bay of Naples. Okay, you've made it as far as Spain, NATO power. Now you still have to go through the Gibraltar Straits, Britain, NATO power, Portugal, NATO power. Finally, you're out in the sea lanes. Okay, if that's too hard, let's come out of the Baltics. Oops, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Germany, the Netherlands, and Denmark, NATO powers. That's why they feel constrained, prisoners of geography.
The Ukraine is one of the, you refer to it as one of the most pressing situations that's faced today. We should turn to Anna now. Now, you wrote, your book was first published in 1997. A lot has changed since then. Bring us up to date with Ukraine.
Well, when I wrote my book, we were still at the sort of tail end of the post-independence honeymoon period, and although there was hyperinflation and very bad governance, appallingly sort of corrupt and incompetent ruling class, it was possible to see a better future for Ukraine. And since then, it's gone through all sorts of ups and downs, but the scenario which a lot of people talked about 20 years ago, which there's bound to be a conflict between East and West, between the more heavily ethnic Russian eastern half of Ukraine and the more ethnically Ukrainian western half of Ukraine, never came to pass. And I thought it never would. But first of all, because Ukrainians are a very pragmatic sort of people. They don't have that burning sense of national pride and national grievance that Russians suffer from. Also, it's sort of people are often only a generation away or two away from the land. They'd have that sort of peasant mentality of being very sensible, feet on the ground, just concentrate on the things that are making the sort of world, immediate world around you better. Also, the vast majority of the country is bilingual. You know, 95% of Ukrainians speak both languages fluently and swap in and out of one or the other depending on context, or speak this rather lovely, currently fashionable amongst young people, mixture of the two, the slang language known as Surzhik. The war broke out in response to... It's very interesting, this. Tim's book is all about geopolitics. It's all about these massive forces, these big empires whose borders are basically defined by coastlines and mountain ranges and rivers and so on, sort of fighting it out over the globe. My perspective from looking in detail at Ukraine over the years, and particularly over the last couple of years and the outbreak of this conflict in the East when Putin invaded using proxy troops plus some of his own regular army, first the Ukraine and then the Donbass in eastern Ukraine, it's about local things. It's actually, you know, one mustn't miss the trees for the wood. Actually, it's about local interests. It was about local cronies, businessman cronies of the deposed president, Yanukovych. It's this grotesquely corrupt ex-criminal man who'd done time in jail, who had in 4 years had fleeced the treasury to the benefit of himself and his family and a small group of friends. And they, when Yanukovych was chucked out by these massive popular revolution on the streets of Kiev in the winter of 2015, his newly enriched semi-criminal businessman friends in Donetsk, his hometown in the east, saw their wealth in danger and perhaps even, you know, the prospect of prosecutions. And some of them fled to Russia and others got together militias to take over the public buildings and to defend their factories and take key points of the big cities of Donetsk and Luhansk. And those militias were, the actual guys who, you know, the staff of these militias were sports club members. You know, if you're a Donetsk businessman, part of your apparatus is a sports club. You own a, you know, maybe a steel mill, you own a TV station, you own a bank, which the money launders for you, but you're also in a sports club, and the sports club is your heavies who enforce your protection rackets and defend you against the heavies of your rival businessmen, because law and order simply doesn't work. You need these guys to hang on to physical control of your assets. So these guys went around breaking into the police stations, breaking into the town halls and taking them over. The police were pretty much on side. Kaganovich was a local guy who put his own guys in charge. They put up a very token resistance. And I think the reason we like to see conflicts like this one in terms of much bigger forces, East versus West, democracy versus autocracy, you know, the Russian Empire and its sort of historic grievances, the sort of NATO expansionism, it's partly because it's just much, much simpler. It's much more interesting. It's got a sort of glamour to it, a big pictureness, seeing it like this, rather than all about, you know, businessman A, businessman B, businessman C, and their various, it's hard holding it in your mind, you know, what their rivalries are and what their assets are and so on. So it's simpler, and B, it panders to our love of conspiracy theories. It's much more fun to think that the revolution was, you know, the revolution which tucked out Yanukovych was engineered by men from Langley in a sort of HQ somewhere with lots of radio masts on the top, than realizing that actually it was about masses and masses of students and ordinary people absolutely being fed up to the back teeth with their ghastly corrupt government. And thirdly, I think we're very self-centered. We love a narrative about foreign affairs which puts ourselves at the center. It makes us feel important. So we love to think that the West is always involved. It's what the West has done or failed to do. It's some Western achievement or Western mistake. You know, it's the West's triumph at the end of the Cold War. Or it's the West's failure that Russia has slid back into autocracy now under Putin. And it also makes it more palatable for Western audiences. You know, it just makes it more interesting to put ourselves at the centre of the story, where in fact it's all about the locals. It's all about them doing their own thing and us actually making surprisingly little difference or any difference at the margins.
Well, let's bring Nick in now to come down on one side or the other, perhaps using the example of Crimea within your book.
Yes, we've been talking about conventional countries up to now. My interest in this particular book is about unconventional countries, or countries that aren't actually recognised by anyone else, or very few other people. And a key example in Anna's case is the Crimea, which declared independence four times in 100 years. The Russians filled it with Russians and got rid of the Crimean Tatars. And by the time they allowed them back more than 40 years later, it was dominantly a Russian part of Ukraine.
Shall we just pop that Russian map back up, actually, just so that people can get an idea?
And I think...
The first one.
And a couple of times within living memory, Ukraine's decided to go back to Mother Russia. First time they were dissuaded. And then most recently, a couple of years ago, or was it 2012, they said, right, we're going to be independent. And then a day later, they were reabsorbed into Mother Russia. So is Ukraine an independent state? Well, it was for a day, and now de facto it's part of Russia. Although if you still look at maps like Tim's, like this one, it's still shown as part of... Oh, well, it's in the doorway here. It's still shown as part of Ukraine, and de jure, officially, it is. But in real terms, you can't use Ukrainian currency in Crimea today, and in practical terms, it's part of Russia. So that's what I'm interested in, is these strange non-countries that aren't shown on the standard political map of the world, and there are lots of them.
But there's a preponderance of them around the Black Sea, perhaps for the very reasons that Tim was talking about.
Yes, splinters of the former Soviet Union. Many of them are supported solely by Russia. like the Ukraine, like Transnistria. There are a couple in enclaves of Georgia which have declared independence, and the only country to recognise them is Russia, like Abkhazia and South Ossetia. So there are a lot of these places that exist solely because they have support from one big boy. It's not just Russia, there are many others. Northern Cyprus, for example, is only recognised by Turkey, and no one else recognises it as a country at all. And yet, in real, practical, everyday terms, it operates like a country.
But that's exactly why it's so difficult to define what a country is.
It is indeed. And actually, once you start looking into it, there's no universally agreed definition of a country. You're always going to find exceptions. There are legal definitions. There's a convention hammered out in Uruguay in the 1930s called the Montevideo Convention. And that has a definition, four-point definition of what makes a country a country. You need a population, you need a claim on territory, you need some form of government, and then you need the ability to enter into relations with other countries, which is pretty woolly. And that ability to enter into relations, so in the case of Northern Cyprus, South Ossetia, Abkhazia, Transnistria, they are countries because they fulfill those criteria. But recognition by other real countries is actually the sort of gold standard, if you like. But even if you look at members of the United Nations, which you might think it's the international club for sovereign countries, that there'd be no question, all members of the UN are countries. Well, yes and no, unfortunately. Taiwan was a member of the United Nations in its early days, and then they kicked it out in 1971. They said, oh, actually, we've only got one seat for China. You've occupied it up to now, and off you go now. It's Red China. So UK does not have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. It's not an official country. And there are many other examples. Israel is a member of the United Nations, but 30-odd countries don't recognise that Israel is a country. So when you actually try and get it cut and dried, it's extremely difficult to define what a country is.
Let's talk a little bit about national identity. Now, Ukraine was looking at building statehood as well as national identity at the same time, without very much lead time, really. How much do you think that has had an impact on how we see Ukraine today?
It's a big disappointment how badly Ukraine has done since independence in 91. I think the comparator, which is often cited, is the one with Poland. They both started off in 1991 at the collapse of the Soviet Union with almost identical GDP per head. And now Poland's GDP per head is four times greater. Poles are four times wealthier than Ukrainians are. But I don't think it's... it's true, you know, Ukraine has been fought over, it's been a battleground numerous times in history, but that's had nothing to do with its current problems. Its current problems, it's an inheritance of basically an incomplete revolution in 91. The existing Ukrainian Communist Party stayed in power. Basically, Moscow was collapsing, and the communists in Kiev thought, well, the only way we can hang on and not be swept away is to declare Ukrainian independence. And so the whole apparatus, you know, not only the top leadership, but also all the officials in the ministries, the judiciary, the police force, everything, they all just carried on and basically took the opportunity to enrich themselves. I mean, there's the lack of sort of public service ethos is really dispiriting. But on the other hand, at the same time, you've got this extraordinary civil society. The young activists, I mean, there are thousands and thousands of them still now, 2 years after the Maidan revolution, spending all their spare time helping Tatar refugees from Crimea or helping refugees from the east, of whom there are over a million in the rest of Ukraine, or sort of watchdog activities on public bodies, or lots of people have gone into parliament. There's a whole new young generation in there, and they're amazing people. And you know, we have nothing to teach them is the answer. Putin and his Putin and his paranoid brain, unless he's putting on the paranoia, unless it's all just a cynical act to justify his actions, thinks that, you know, the West is behind all this, and we're training up all these opposition people in Ukraine and elsewhere. We have nothing to teach them. they're 10 times more resourceful, inventive, thorough, brave than we are.
I wonder what we can learn about the Ukrainians in that the first line of their national anthem is "Ukraine is not dead yet."
Yes, that's right. It's also Poland has got almost exactly the same first line in its national anthem as well. And it's because, like Poland through the 19th century, Ukraine for a long time, you know, existed in the imagination of Ukrainians. They dreamt of a truly independent Ukraine, and they only got it, apart from a few sort of very brief and unsuccessful attempts in the middle of civil wars, in 1991. And there is still a sort of disconnect between the Ukrainian people's minds, which has often been sort of nurtured, you know, through lifetimes, particularly for diaspora Ukrainians and Ukrainian Canadians or Ukrainian Americans and real Ukraine. And they often, you know, Ukrainian Canadians have been brought up with the idea of this Ukraine as sort of sunny sunflower fields and girls with flowers in their hair dancing and so on. They've been to their Ukrainian Saturday school all through their youth. And they come to the real Ukraine and it's a bit of a shock.
I was just going to say there are many examples of regions of pre-existing countries that have that feeling of some sort of separate corporate identity, which do eventually become countries, and clearly Ukraine is one example.
I wonder whether we might go on to the third map, which is a map of the Middle East, and talk to Tim, start our conversation about borders.
Well, the one between Syria and Iraq is an artificial one, which is why it's only lasted, 80 years? There were tribes in Iraq and tribes in Syria that were connected with each other and felt an affinity with each other, would intermarry. It could be hundreds of miles apart. And then some fool came along from a big city like Baghdad and said to them, by the way, you're not living here anymore. You're living in this country called Iraq. And what? Iraq. And you need this piece of paper if you want to go and visit your cousin over there. And they said, we need to do what? Because some bloke in London has told us to do this? It never made any sense. And, of course, it's fallen apart at the first time of asking. Ditto Syria, to a lesser extent, Saudi. When the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, ruled Iraq, they saw it very clearly as three distinct regions, vilayats. And they ruled it as three very distinct regions. The idea of putting them all together and saying that you were a state is ridiculous. They weren't even a nation, because there was the Shia majority down south, the Sunni Arab majority in the middle, and the Kurds up the north, who are the Kurds are the biggest nation without a state, although they're in the middle of trying to form one at the moment, as we see on the border of Turkey at the moment. So if you create things which are not don't make geographical and cultural sense, they will fall apart eventually, probably. They are in the process of doing that. I think they're in the process of a 30-year war. Most civil wars last about 13 years. This one is about to enter its sixth year in Syria. There's no end in sight. And part of that jigsaw is when you look up towards the Syrian-Turkey border, part of that area is Kurdish. They seek to have a contiguous area all the way along up to the Iraq and through to Turkey and Iran and create a nation state. And it's not going to happen because the big players will make damn sure it doesn't. The other way to look at the conflict in Syria, if you look at Iran, Shia dominated. The American invasion of Iraq delivered a Shia majority government to Baghdad. It wasn't their intention, but they did. If you then keep moving west, you go through Damascus, which is led by the Alawites, who are an offshoot of Shia, who have connections back with the Shia in Iraq and back with the Shia in Iran. If you go a bit further west, you end up in Beirut, and the greatest military power in the state of Lebanon is not the army, it is Hezbollah, which is Shia. I now can give you a corridor from the Mediterranean to Iran, and they aim to keep that corridor open. That's where the money flows, that's where the arms flows, that gives you regional power. And the Sunnis in the area mean to break that corridor. And in extraordinarily broad brush terms, that's what that's about.
The other area of concern perhaps for this region is that there is no longer a buffer in terms of Iraq between the axis of Iran and Saudi Arabia.
It's extremely problematic. They have had many, many centuries of suspicion with each other. There's also the added problem. The Iranians, since the revolution, believe themselves to be the guardians of Islam. It doesn't matter that Shia are a minority of Islam. It's their version of Islam, and they think it should be the one that rules the world. Conversely, in Saudi Arabia, they are the custodians of the two holy places, Mecca and Medina, and they think their version of Islam should be the one that rules the world. So they are in competition there. They're in competition for oil. They're in competition for the hearts and minds of the region, and that is part of what is either a 30-year war or a, we've had 100-year wars. They may well be having a 100-year war at the moment, and it's partially based on geography, only partially. It's just the overlooked bit.
So, Nick, this idea of a border in the European sense was a completely alien concept, and perhaps still is in many areas of the world, isn't it?
It's a relatively recent global idea, and it's been imposed on lots of peoples all over the planet, largely by Europeans, in order to come up with this political map of the world that we know today, which actually stems very largely from the end of the Second World War, the rise of United Nations, end of colonialism. But in lots of parts of the world, the idea of having a very fixed boundary line, and you're on that side and you're on that side and you're from different places, is anathema to lots of local people. Actually, in practice, many borders are still quite porous, and people do move across them freely. But there are also many other borders which are very closely guarded. But pre-19th century, in many parts of the world, the idea of a fixed line as being that's yours, was completely unknown. And indeed, you might have a border on a route, a roadway, and say, right, OK, this is where the jurisdiction ends. But off-piste, as it were, there'd be no border at all, because there's no point in having a border. No one's interested in what's away from the road. And it's only actually when European powers started carving up the planet in search of resources, physical resources in many cases, that local rulers said, oh, actually, perhaps we do need to know where our territory runs out, because otherwise the other lot will have it. And that has been the case in many, many parts of the world, as it was in Europe, if you go back 500, 600, 700 years ago.
So, driven by fear in some ways. I mean, let's talk about one of the countries that don't exist in your book, Baluchistan.
Yeah, well, it appears, or at least doesn't appear, on this map, which is still up there. So we're down on the border between Iran and Pakistan, so on the far right-hand side, about in the middle. And it's Baluchistan is a classic example of divide and rule. So the borders there were largely drawn by the Brits. When it came to the end of their rule in that part of the world, they said, OK, right, well, we'll have this boundary here, here and here. And Baluchis are now divided between Pakistan, Iran, and there are a few in Afghanistan. And Baluchistan, which is a non-country, which has tried to be a country, they actually declared their own independence. I think it was a day after India and Pakistan did, but no one took any notice. Therefore, the Baluchis have been split ever since. And their country is a non-country because actually, de facto, it's in the territory of three separate countries.
And so what does that mean then for those three separate countries? I mean, in Pakistan, that's potentially
trouble.
A problem.
Trouble is the word, I think.
Yeah, if I could pick up on that. Right at the very bottom of Baluchistan, which is at the bottom of Afghanistan in the Pakistani part, it's one of the regions of Pakistan. Geographically, it's quite well defined. And so culturally and linguistically, the Baluchis are different to, say, the Punjabis. And there is a geographical delineation between them. But the Pakistanis insist that they remain part of Pakistan. There has been a low-level insurgency there for some time. The Chinese are now building a massive... Well, they built a massive port in Gwadar on the coast, and they're now building a four-lane highway and a railway so that they can get all their goods straight out of the Middle East instead of having to go through the Strait of Malacca which is controlled by the Americans, and then into the ports. You go to the Gwadar, and you go up the four-lane highway, and you come into Xinjiang in China, and then you get the goods there. To do that, they're having to create a force of 20,000 strong security to guard that four-lane highway, because Baluchistan is such a volatile area because it's a nation without a state. And if you spread the sunshine around, as we used to say at border crossings, if you spread the sunshine around enough, you'll keep people quiet. But the Pakistani state has not spread the sunshine around, and it's one of the poorest regions. And so if you don't spread the sunshine and you have a nation with no state, you will have trouble.
On people without a state, I was volunteering at the jungle in Calais a few weeks ago, partly, I have to admit, simply out of curiosity. And one of the groups of young guys I chatted to, they said, oh, we're from Kuwait. And I said, why are you here living in these sort of half-collapsed tents in pools of liquid mud if you're from Kuwait, which is a peaceful, prosperous country? And they said, oh, but we're not Kuwaitis, we're Bedou. And I don't know the details of sort of what form of second-class citizenship Bedouin have.
It's Bedoun, meaning without. A state, Bedoun, rather than Bedou as in nomadic. Yeah.
And they told me that they were unable to get jobs or proper education or anything in Kuwait, hence they were here trying to jump on freight trains to the UK. But I mean, is this a case of people, the Bedou don't recognise national borders, they're still nomadic, so in turn the authorities refuse to recognise them? Is this a sort of tip for tat?
No, it's people not being given citizenship because of their family history, not part of the right tribe, those sorts of things. So it is, yeah, it's Bedoun meaning without. Let me come back to the Ukraine. How important to Ukrainian national identity is the Crimea?
Is the Crimea? Well, Crimea was handed to Ukraine, to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, as it was then, in the 50s by Khrushchev. And in those days, of course, Ukraine was simply part of the USSR, and this was a purely sort of token bit of it was marking an anniversary. So it had no administrative or political significance at all. So when Ukraine became independent in 1991, Crimea became part. Crimea went with it, but there were referendums on independence, or whether to take independence or not, in all the separate provinces of Ukraine. And Crimea did vote pro in January 1992, but only very narrowly. It was the narrowest vote of any Ukrainian region. And since then, it's been a rather typically sort of, badly run provincial part of Ukraine, apart from Sevastopol, the naval port, which was leased to Russia on a long lease, where they continued to have a naval base. And but there was no... When Putin invaded Crimea with his anonymous green men, as the Ukrainians called them. This was a joke on us, the green men. They wore green uniforms. It was also, where do you think they came from? Do you think they came from Mars? when the Western media refused to recognise these were Russian troops, long after, weeks and weeks after, sources on the ground identified exactly which units they were from and where in Russia they were from. When that happened, I mean, there were certainly cheering crowds on the streets, but also people being arrested, and there were quite a few murders and abductions and so on, and all the opposition was chased out of Crimea very swiftly, and there's been no possibility since of doing anything like a fair and proper polling, real surveying of public opinion on the question. So it's very hard to tell what people actually wanted then or now. But of course the real losers, the people who Crimea really belongs to, are the Crimean Tatars. And I remember interviewing back in 91 a really heroic man called Mustafa Zhemilev, who during the Soviet period, he's a Crimean Tatar, he was transported as a small baby with his family. They were all deported to Central Asia at the end of the war. And this is one of these awful sort of cattle cart mass deportations which the Russian NKVD organised, in which sort of 30%, 50% of people died on the journey, corpses being thrown out of the doors, all this kind of thing, and then being dumped in sort of wastelands with no tools, no shelter, no nothing at the end of it, and then more people dying in the first winter. So told to set up a collective farm, inverted commas. And so he had survived this kind of all this and come back in the late 80s when Perestroika allowed Tatars to start returning to Crimea. And they live in sort of, they still to this day live in sort of containers on the hillsides outside their towns. They've never got their original flats and houses and farms back. And he has led, in the 20 years since Ukrainian independence, a wonderful Crimean Tatar. He's been the political leader of the Tatars, and he's an extremely wise an intelligent man who was great friends with Sakharov during his years in prison. He was a dissident in the Soviet times, and he was put in the gulag for many years, and in where he got to know all the Russian dissidents too. And after Ukrainian independence, he led the Tatar political movement, but he's always preached no violence, and he's managed to keep it completely policeful and political, which is quite an achievement given how badly off they are. And now he has been exiled again, and he's now living in Kiev as an old man, you know, for the second time in his life, exiled from his own native land, from Crimea.
What sort of proportion of the population are made up of Tatars in Ukraine, do we know?
It's about 200,000 in Crimea, so they're a minority, but a substantial minority.
Okay.
But not all that many actually have left for you know, Ukraine proper since the Russian takeover. About between 10 and 20,000, fewer than expected.
Okay, I think we've got time for a couple of questions. If anybody wants to stick their hand up, we can get a microphone to you. There's a question down here. Thank you. Do we have a microphone?
It's just on its way here. Faster.
Over here, please. Thank you very much, Roddy.
Hello, Anna. I just wanted to say we have visited Ukraine several times, so it's very interesting what you said then.
Hold the microphone quite close to your mouth.
We visited Ukraine several times, so what Anna said was very interesting, in that however much Putin is mixing it over there, the Ukrainians see their problems as brought on by other Ukrainians, i.e. the rich oligarchs that you were mentioning, and that they are their conflicts are over money and power from other Ukrainians, and they're enormously sad about it, but they can't work out how to improve it.
Well, it's Putin too, of course. I mean, since Putin invaded the Donbass, partly regular troops have come in and out across the border, but mostly it's proxies, it's Russian-funded and organised militias, and they, that's been an enormous drain on Ukraine's resources. Rebuilding the army and fighting this, low-level war in the east there. And looking after all the refugees, rehousing them, finding jobs and welfare and system and so on for them. And that's hindered Ukraine's attempts at economic reform. It's been very damaging in that way. And it's also poisoned the politics, because of course now the Ukrainian right, it's encouraged the rise of the Ukrainian right, which is still thankfully extremely small. But it's just made everything harder and more difficult. It's been a really damaging. It's an incredibly stupid and unnecessary little war. I mean, I can't stress how idiotic it is. Your overwhelming urge when you're there is to sort of take one side by the scruff of its neck and the other and put them both in naughty rooms and say no computer time. You know, it's a dumb, dumb conflict. This was my first real conflict zone, and Tim obviously is. I expect that's a response you're familiar with.
Yes, most of them are very, very stupid. But can we go back to the map of Europe, please? There we go. In fact, let's go to the map of Russia. I agree with everything that you've said, Anna, but you talked about the micro and how that it's actually about what's going on in the ground. And I agree with you, but the idea that the West is not a player in this, I don't agree with. We knew that if we pulled Ukraine away economically into a geographical sphere of influence, which is the West and the EU, there would be repercussions, and we gambled. I knew for a fact, because I can see into the future, I knew for a fact the moment the president fled, Russia would invade Crimea. Now, I'm only a journalist. If I knew that Russia was going to invade Crimea, I'm sure the people in the Foreign Office knew, and yet we still offered an EU trade deal, and we pulled them towards us for a big geopolitical reason. Ditto, these oligarchs and criminals that control the Donbass are tin pot guys that should be running a leisure centre in Harrogate if they manage to get asylum. You know, they're not real players. They all have kickboxing teams. That's how, you know, they get the muscle. But the idea that if it wasn't part of a big geopolitical game, they could survive is nonsense. They know we'll get the kickboxers, we'll get the militia, we'll get the muscle together, because we know that that bloke Putin will funnel the money and the troops and all the help towards us. Because if they don't, if Putin just turned the tap off, Ukraine could be whole again. So it is micro, but it's also a big game.
I think it's the other way around in Ukraine. It's the big business controlling
the
politicians.
It's the same thing at the same time.
The richest man in Ukraine, Rinat Akhmetov, who has a large flat in number one Hyde Park, you know, the very swish new flats at the bottom side of Hyde Park. You know, he was Yanukovych's paymaster. And when Yanukovych fled, which he did in fear of his life, I'm sure, he made a decision. Shall I throw in my lot with the new government and the new EU trade treaty, which now hopefully will actually get signed? Or shall I go with my militias and try and carve out a space for myself, hopefully cross fingers with Putin's support, in my homeland in the east? And he decided on the latter. And Putin saw the opportunity and thought, yeah, I'll go in there, you know. Putin took the gamble. I mean, we for years have been negotiating this trade treaty, and there'd been no response from Moscow. I mean, it was not until Yanukovych fled that Moscow saw the opportunity, and it obviously was a gamble on Putin's part, and invaded Crimea. I mean, if you knew if you spotted Crimea was about to invade it, you were, you know, that was a remarkably prescient of you, because I spent my life going to seminars on whether Ukraine, whether Russia, with sort of, you know, diplomats next to
it. It's an existential matter.
Lobbyists, and none of them saw it coming. It was an immense surprise to the foreign policy establishment.
Interests. Which never changed because of geography. It's the only warm water port they have. There is not a chance in hell that any Russian leader, even a democratic Russian leader, would have let the Crimea go.
There was no prospect of it going. The new government never said that they were going to rescind the lease.
But there are many examples around the world of existential threats. For example, the moment anyone in the PA puts heavy weapons on the West Bank, there will be a war, because Israel will not be cut in half because it's 12 miles wide at one point. You know on existential threats what will happen, because it's a matter of life and death for the nation, and the warm water port of Crimea was a matter of life and death, existential matter for that rather strange chap.
I have to tell everyone, the mainstream, you know, sort of view is that this was a short. This is about Putin hanging on to power. You know, it was an opportunistic political play to boost his popularity rating. So it's an easy win. It wasn't about him thinking long term about the welfare of his country. You know, if he were thinking like that, he would not be acting the way he is.
I told you it was going to be a meaty discussion, didn't I? And it turned out to be so. Thank you so much.
You.
Now, all three books are available over at the Stanford signing shop there. Prisoners of Geography is a great read, really accessible geopolitics, wonderful. If you want an in-depth discussion about Ukraine and some insight, Borderland, also equally wonderful. And possibly the most beautifully designed book on the Stanford's the Stanford's bookshop there, is an atlas of countries that don't exist. They're all cut out for you so that you can see how they don't fit in to the rest of the world, or do, whichever is your perspective. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your question, Madam. Most of all, thank you to you three.
Thank you.